Assalamu alaikum, hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Retail Remix Stories powered by Find. This is your place to be up close and personal with inspiring business leaders who are not just building great businesses, but through their massively transformative purpose, are also shaping the future of commerce in the region. We've touched upon a lot of categories so far, but today we are talking uniquely about B2B platforms. And the person talking to us is multifaceted serial entrepreneur and today leading one of the most exciting brands in the region in this space. Please welcome Harsh Sajnani, the CEO and founder of Kingpin.
Wow, what an introduction. Thank you so much. I'm so grateful for that and grateful for being here as well.
Welcome to the show, Harsh. I think this story is all about inspirations, right? So we start off, of course, we want to find out more about your business and your vision for the long term. But it always starts with the person behind the personal, behind the professional, right? 100%. So would love to understand your growing up days, where did you grow up? What was key influences on you like?
Yeah.
What did you study? What did you do?
Wow, that's a good question to start off with. Let's start off with a little bit about me. I'm Harsh Sajnani, born and raised in Dubai. I actually come from three generations in this wholesale retail space.
Wow, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, it actually started off with my grandfather who came here in the
50s. Literally in your blood.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes it's tough to get out of it. I tried to run. I tried to run many times, but right. Couldn't get out of it. Started off with my grandfather, actually. What he started off, he came here in the 50s in Dubai. Back then, I don't think the Seven Emirates had even come together.
Right.
It was right before the 1971.
Right.
And back then, I remember they were trading in the rupees. He was driving from Dubai all the way to Al-Ain, buying and selling fabrics, silks. Wow. That's what his game was.
Right.
And that set essentially the Petri dish for my dad to come here in the 80s. He came here in the 80s and really, I think he was the second gen guy. Took it to the next level. Went from not just supplying textiles between these two cities, but across the region, Southeast Asia, Eastern Europe. And he really specialized in silks and luxury fabrics for women. And I think that was a big jump between my grandfather and my father. I think they had, the father-son situations as well.
Nice.
But then what was very exciting, which, I give props, a lot of props to my dad for this. He foresaw that his kids were going to grow up and at some point wanted to get into business like he did.
Right.
And, he could see that the textile industry was in a sunset. Right?
Right.
Long credit terms, heavy inventory, people going direct, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And so he started vertically integrating. And that journey started in the late 90s, early 2000s. And I think that actually led to the foundation of the business. So we went from textiles to manufacturing to retail. And that was the evolution that was happening. And as I was growing up.
Right.
So I'm growing up. I'm there and getting my first glimpses of business. And I see my dad going a bit AWOL, like going all over the place, right. Going down the stream. And it was very exciting.
Right.
I think it was probably in, I would say, the early 2010s when I started getting older. I was around 15 when it was 2010. So right. I was like applying for university, as you can imagine, figuring out what do I want to do. And like most Sindhi kids born and brought up in Dubai, I had a massive stamp on my head, if I'm being honest. The stamp was like, hey, this is my firstborn son. He's going to take over the family business, going to come in. And I thought for the longest time...
He's the kingpin.
I mean, this was much before kingpin came into the picture. And funny story about that. But that essentially set the foundation for me to join. And I think, unfortunately, I wasn't really a fashion guy, a design guy. I think both my dad and my grandfather had this like touch of creativity, a touch of design, which I think it blossomed later in my life. But what was actually beautiful about it was that my dad started diversifying. So he started diversifying into IT and so on. So for me, when I was at university, I studied maths and stats, by the way.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah.
So I've been very much numbers guy, very, very systematic thinking.
Really?
And so that's where I think my affinity towards problem solving came.
Right.
And at the same time, when you're in university, 17, 18 years old, you're seeing Uber come up on the apps.
Right.
And you're there going to a nightclub, creating a fake account, getting $10, getting $10, getting to the club, coming back as well, doing it with all the boys. That was my first taste into this world of technology, and I loved it. I was hooked. And so, you know, post-university...
You also did a stint at Uber, right?
I did, yes.
Okay.
It was an Uber challenge. They had this thing when we were at university. I think we were like very young. It was like first or second year. And they had this thing. They were like going through this acquisition spree.
Right.
They wanted to have more and more riders.
All right, okay.
So what they were like, okay, cool. How the hell are we going to get these riders? They chose 26 students across the entire UK. And what they told us was like, hey, go and figure it out. And all so right. I remember we were hustling. And I remember a friend of mine actually found out that there was this like... segment of mums on the outer skirts of London who had time between 12 to 6 p.m. whilst their kids were at school and activities where they had a car chilling, and they were like a perfect segment to expand Uber's supply base. So we tapped into that really well. And
Nice.
Yeah. But that was also interesting. Like when you're at university, you think, you know, when you're so young, you think that work is like literally a desk job. You're sitting down, and then what I loved about the tech space was that there was a lot of hacking, there was a lot of hustling.
Yes,
resonated well.
Yes.
When I left university, I actually got into aircraft leasing. So I was a quant financial analyst doing all the problem solving of how is this aircraft valued? Should we buy it? Should we lease it? Who do we lease it to? At what price? At what etc. And I loved the problem solving behind that. But I'll tell you something, that's really when I realized that I needed something more. Because at that time, I was just hearing stories of my dad diversifying the business. Things were exploding out here in Dubai. He's getting into the IT space. I'm a big fan of tech. I'm like, finally, like, what am I doing in London? Like, I have a startup in my own backyard. I should go back. And that's where it began. But that's where actually the story began of how I got into this retail space in particular.
Oh, nice, nice. And how long has it been since you've been here now?
Oof. I've born and raised in Dubai. I was in the UK for 5 years, came back. It's been since 2016. My first year joining the family business, they threw me in the warehouse. My dad was like, you're the firstborn son. The second one's a doctor. Like, who's going to take this over? I'm not going to wait another 10 years. And that was his value prop to me. I was like, okay, cool. I'm jumping in. And started off in the warehouse, worked my way up. And after a while, I just learned that, he wanted me to be close to the industry. We had textiles, we had manufacturing, we had retail.
Yeah.
All great businesses, a lot of people doing them. But for me, I wanted something a little bit more scalable. And so what we saw was that there was an opportunity to build a distribution arm.
Right.
And that's where my game in the trade began. Getting into the distribution side via the tech experience. So I went to Step Conference in 2016, 2017.
Oh, right.
They had this new e-commerce company that came up. It was eLabels at the time. Not sure if they're still around, but that was the first account that I met.
Right.
Went to them, pitched them the family business brands. They were like, too expensive, you don't know. And then they told me a list of brands that they were looking for. I knew one of them, picked up the phone, closed my first deal. I was 21 at the time, had no idea what a packing list, bill of lading was. But figured out that deal. Within 3 weeks, they tripled the order. And that set the foundation for us to build up our distribution arm. 4 years later, that grew to, you know, 1 to 35 brands, 150 accounts, Middle East, Southeast Asia. We went from a team of one person in an office the size of this table, selling out of samples and bags. It was an experiment at the start, right?
Right.
To literally a showroom, 4,000 square foot, D3, right in the heart and center of it.
Amazing.
And that was probably one of the most rewarding but exciting experiences of my time. First time building a proper business. I had a lot of support, of course, but incredible team, lots of guidance from my dad. I can never take that away from him.
Right.
But that's how the foundation was set on how I got into the retail space.
Amazing. Why the name Kingpin?
So Kingpin actually came after my stint at my family business. I can tell you the name, why Kingpin. What we learned is that, you know, this industry is so based on relationships. And whether you're a brand looking to enter a new territory, you want to have relationships with the retailers. You want to have relations with agencies, distributors who are opening up those markets for you. And what we saw was that the retailers have the vice versa as well, right? They have the same relationships with the brands that they work with.
Right.
And what we saw was that when we went out to actually build a business like this, we saw that there was so much that we could do by connecting the people in the industry, the products that they sold, the prices by which they sold them, and then the processes that run for them to actually run that whole flow. And we thought, like, what name would embody that whole spirit in a way that's powerful, but also makes people realize that it's intelligent, that they can rely on it. And, you know, we work in a market that's run by distributors. They're the kingpins.
Right.
Right. And we serve the distributors. Right. The brands looking to enter a new territory, they need the contacts, they need the access. They're looking for the kingpin. And so.
Right. And that's how the name was born.
That's how the name was born. Actually, right. One of our brands that I was distributing a while ago, we were pitching for so many brands when it was in my family business, and it was all networking, it was all relationship based. And I remember that there was this new brand, NAKD, and the head of wholesale there, when he met me, he didn't even have Middle East on his radar. He had 40 countries, US, Germany, France, UK distributors planned everywhere. And we were the 41st distributor, because he was like, Middle East, I never even knew you guys have a market out there. And I was like, of course we do. And I was like, this is the market, blah, blah. He did a background check and he asked, coincidentally, two other brands we were already distributing. They gave me a great reference. And he's like, oh, I heard you guys are the kingpins. I was like, you know what? I don't know if I would agree with that, but that name is fantastic. I'm going to use it some point later in my life.
And
3 years later, when I left the family business, we launched Kingpin.
Oh, nice. Amazing. Amazing. And you are an achiever, right? You've been in the Forbes 30 under 30 list already. And there's so much that you're looking forward to, right? So, but the business you are in is essentially your traditional business in that sense. Like you rightly said, it's relationship driven, mm-hmm. even from a B2B perspective, right? Was there an aha moment that told you that this could be done differently from the way that your, you know, two generations of your family have been doing it?
For sure. Yeah. So this happened when, you know, when I was running the family business, what we saw was that running a wholesale business is on relationships, but, you know, it's also quite fragmented in many ways. And what I mean by that is, let's say I'm a distributor or I'm a brand and I want to sell to shops. I sell to many different types of shops. Different shops buy different products from me. They buy different products from me at different times of the year. They buy them in different quantity. They buy them sometimes because of the fact that they're buying at different quantities. I'm giving each of them different prices.
Right.
And each of their processes are different as well. And so what we saw was that as I continued growing the distribution business, We basically put all the levers in place for us to scale. We had a negative cash cycle. We had zero inventory. We were clean. But one thing that kept bottlenecking us was all the processes that are involved. And essentially today, brands and distributors, they often resort to Excel sheets.
Yes.
They prepare the Excel sheet and they'll have a PDF catalog or like images inside this file. They share it. Now, because they have so many different products for different people, different price points, they change the pricing. It's easy for them to execute. They send it to the buyer. And that's how B2B is done on the seller side. You flip that equation on the buyer side and you actually start to feel really bad because the buyers actually receive hundreds of these different line sheets, different things. And, you know, as a salesperson, you want that order. You don't want to be out of mind. So the buyers have the pain point. They also have this whole wave of new sellers approaching them as well. And they want to fill in a category, a gap, a price point, a missing segment in their business, which helps them drive revenue. But the way that they can access this is so broken, right. Even trade shows and so on. So what we saw was that this was so broken. And then that was our deep understanding of the problem. I really wanted to fix this problem. I guess that's where the stats, maths, problem-solving brain came right. about and wanted to really go out and solve it.
Right.
But I'll tell you another thing. Another thing that I realized whilst we went out to solve it was that, hey, we're not recreating the wheel here, right? E-catalog, order management, it's not rocket science. Yeah. Like, it doesn't take a genius to figure it out. And that's why when people were like, oh, you're so smart, you cracked this B2B. I was like, really? It's not, people done this. Like, yeah. But I tell you where we learned that it was a the sweet intersection between knowing the industry and knowing what tech is available,
right,
you start to see why not everyone took off. And I'll give you the best example of this. So B2B e-commerce is there. And a lot of brands, I would say about 20%, 30% in Europe, probably 40% nowadays. In the US, it's a lot more. In the Middle East, like really low, like really, really low, like right. sub 5%, sub 3% today.
Okay.
Use B2B platforms. What you see is that when people use these B2B platforms, they think, hey, problem solved.
Yeah.
Because now I'm giving the buyer a digital catalog. They can order from me anytime they want. They see the live inventory. Hallelujah.
Yeah.
But what they often misunderstand is that, hey, on the buyer side, instead of now, if everyone got their own B2B platform, instead of having 20 Excel sheets, now they're receiving 20 logins.
Yeah.
And now not only do they need to learn how to use 20 different systems, they also need to learn how to have a copy of that data that they just placed an order for, and how do they right. track, and how do I figure this out?
Right.
And so what we saw was that, hey, like this approach that is happening in the industry is not going to solve its problems. And it was validated time after time after time. When we continued building Kingpin, we saw loads of our clients were like, hey, look, like we've invested $100,000 with SAP and with, I don't know, these like Commerce Cloud solution yeah. and Magento and et cetera. I'm like, what's so different about you? We say yeah. like, hey, like when a buyer comes into Kingpin, they can work with all the sellers that they work with, right? And they don't need to have 20 logins.
Yeah.
And that ecosystem that we're trying to create, we're creating, is really what sets us apart. And like I said, it's the Kingpin name comes about from right. that ethos that right. we're really trying to connect it in a way that's never been done before.
Right, amazing. And I think one of the challenges always in the tech space is everyone tries to Amazonify their offering, right? How's Kingpin evolved there, right? Because from being, how did the platform really evolve? So?
Great, great question. So I'll tell you that over the last 18 months, we have evolved in a way that when I started this business, I only had as a vision. But over the last 2-3 years, there's been a seismic shift in the way you can actually unlock value for the customer. And that's without going into the buzzword, but it's AI. Mm-hmm. And artificial intelligence has really enabled entrepreneurs like myself to bring your vision to reality way sooner. Now, we do that in a majority of ways today. So how has the platform evolved? What Kingpin is, in a nutshell, for the viewers?
Yeah, they definitely want to know.
Yeah, so Kingpin is an AI-powered, well, AI-native revenue engine that allows brands to find, approach, and convert new B2B buyers at scale. So if you're a fashion brand, a beauty brand, a sports brand, even an FMCG brand, and you're looking to grow your business, generally what we see is that you start with choosing the markets you want to enter, figuring out what sorts of channels you want to go into, right? You want to go into sports chains, you want to go into e-commerce, boutiques, and then from there, narrowing down which of those retailers are a perfect match in that positioning, in that segment, but also which of them match your positioning, your price point, etc. After that, after you get the right store, what do you do next? You do the building relationship part. You right. reach out to the buyers, you get their contacts, ask a friend, go check on online. But what our system does, it gets you the contacts. You connect your emails. AI will draft, approach, personalize, and build those pipelines with all of them until they respond. And once they want to see your catalogs, you have a full-blown B2B order management solution that's fully connected with all your ERPs, your system. And so our vision is that we're going to connect the people, products, and processes, but do it in a way that's going to bring about a new revolution in how retail is done, not only here, but
globally.
That's the plan.
Yeah, amazing. Awesome. I think one of the challenges of the B2B business is that the value chain is multidimensional. There's product, there's category, there's for lack of a better word, financial, enablement, mm-hmm. Right? And then there's logistics. So how do you kind of foresee and where do you kind of put in your efforts to build the ecosystem?
Sure. what we saw was that, so where do we want to play in this ecosystem? So what we saw was that in this entire stack, what we really focus about is eliminating the fragmentation and consolidating it. So our strategy is very, very, very clear. We want to consolidate the people, products, and processes all in one place.
Right.
Just out of context, financing, logistics, incredible value adds to the value chain. Because if you're doing a 90-day credit, you need your cash up front
right.
as a supplier. If you're a buyer and you're placing a large order, you want flexible payment terms. Shipments, especially when you're going into Saudi, you need to do the SASO, Saber certificate. Takes a process. You need to follow. Russia has the same thing. US has a similar thing as well for certificates. We put those two in financing and logistics. But what we see is that often they come secondary after the people have met, they have connected, bought and sold the products,
right.
and then run their processes to close that transaction. Then everything else will come into the play.
All right.
What we see is that when we play along this space, we're actually creating value not only for the brands, the retailers, the distributors, the agents, the employees on both sides and the people driving that. But when we do that really well, we see that the ecosystem works well. Context, like last year, we did close to $200 million worth of transactions on Kingpin on the platform. And what we saw was that as soon as we're not very public about it, but when we announced it, we saw that a lot of fintechs who do buy now, pay later, revenue-based financing, started reaching out. They're like, hey, cool. Like, can we roll this out, plug and play? And we're like, yes. But what we learned very quickly was that B2B financing is still at its nascent stages
right.
in terms of its evolution. What we see is that people have successfully cracked local market financing,
right.
single corridor financing, maybe dual corridor. But as soon as you get into B2B trade, you're selling multi-territory.
Right.
You're selling into Kuwait. You're selling into Saudi. Yeah. How are you going to finance all those? I have a new customer today. He's come in from Nigeria. He wants to buy, $200,000 worth of goods. Like, you're going to finance? How are you going to finance that? So that's where we felt like it's not ready yet. So we thought to ourselves, like, hey, it's better we play our strategy.
Right.
When they are ready, we'll be there to welcome them with open arms so that the entire ecosystem benefits from these other value-added services.
Nice. No, I think very good way to put it, right? Because typically what would happen is we'd go after all these value adds before actually getting into the market.
Yeah.
But playing to your strengths, it means customer first always.
Yes, always.
Customer before platform.
100%.
Ah, great idea. I think one of the other challenges with B2B is multiplicity of decision makers, right? So that's like a big, like, I think the biggest difference that I see between B2C and B2B is there's one transaction, one customer, one decision maker versus multiple decision makers on one side. How do you kind of build that?
Yeah. So one thing that we did very, very early on in our journey at Kingpin was that we saw that, on the sell side, there's so many stakeholders involved in the transaction. You got the sales rep, you got the sales manager, you got the ops guy, you got the finance guy, you got the logistics guy, got everyone on that side. On the buyer side, you got the mirror image of these people, and you got approvals and so on. On a general transaction, you go to a small shop, all of a sudden you're dealing with the shop owner. So one guy making the decision. So for him, it's like, oh, the easier you make my life, the better. You go more corporate. Now they have formats, right? Some of the major retailers in the region, they have their own formats on which they place purchase orders. How do you give them, like, how can you be a platform that serves all of these use cases in a way? But the deep reality is that all that they care about is an ease of user experience. And number two, which is let them do their work outside your platform as well.
Yeah.
They have a ERP where they need to raise purchase orders. They have a format that the team is tired of filling. We're in the age of AI. I can give it to you in whatever format you want and let you run your business.
Yeah.
Whereas we as Kingpin stay in that place of connecting the people, products, and processes. Yeah. So that would fall under processes for us. And in terms of decision making, you kind of understand how we played because we're always focused laser on how can we put ourselves in a position where the ecosystem gravitates more and more towards us and then they see the value and the flywheel keeps turning like that.
So you put the structure on the chaos, right? Really?
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing. I think And I think you touched upon this already, but working capital is seen as a moat, right? And while you touched upon it, saying that, you know, this may not be a priority right now because the ecosystem doesn't exist. But how do you see this playing out over the next 3 to 5 years, right? Which is when essentially the business is also growing, the concept of B2B platforms is also scaling up.
Oh, yes. So I think the world that we're ending, driving towards is a world where I fundamentally believe, and we're relentlessly executing to bring that reality into life, is where every human being involved in this value chain is spending no time doing the work that is low value and more like that a system can do better. I'll give you the best example, sell through. Do you hire a head of distribution to reconcile the data and make sure you have the best report? Or do you actually hire him that once he reviews the sell through, he knows exactly what to replenish, where, at what time and where, right? And how much, right?
Yeah.
And so what we see is that a lot of, like 80% of the time, 60 to 80% of the time that people spend is most of the time on this. And that part, of which is the high value task, is what we really want to amplify. And we believe that today, with the power that we wield, with the power of AI, we're accelerating further towards that mission. Now, what does that do? You're looking at a future where a brand would be able to get inspired, walk out, figure out just through their inspiration, the brand owner, the creatives on a travel, figure out the theme for their next assortment. They'd get some other tools to build their assortment, plan it. They'd have their production in line. They'd plug into Kingpin. Kingpin's AI agent would go and figure out exactly where in the world, what channels of sales, what exact retailers, who in those retailers, at what quantity, at what proposal price, should they go out and do the outreach. It would go out and set up the meetings, because we know that humans at the end of the day have to go in and build a relationship, structure the deal. Relationships and trust are very valuable in B2B. You could have the best product in the world, best price point. You're not going to get the deal if the buyer doesn't trust you and you don't have that human connect.
Right.
And on the buyer side, what we see is that buyers would be focusing more on creating their community, curating their assortment, because retailers would focus on curating that experience for their customer, curating the assortment that would basically be done on top of the AI. AI would take care of all of the work on the Kingpin buyer portal. That would done. Okay. And retailers would focus on curation and community. Brands would focus on their identity, the community that they build, their following, who they are. And both sides would personify in that regard. And humans would be focused on just to build relationships and really do the high value tasks. And everything in the back end would be done. To the degree where I fundamentally believe that you'd see a world where if two shops are on the same street and both buy the same brand, they would both have individual assortments without anyone having to do any manual work. Not only would they have individual assortments, but if for one reason shop A didn't buy enough yellows, Kingpin would recommend shop B to buy the yellows because, hey, we know that that shop doesn't have it and we know that on your street, this is the rate of sale and you should be buying those. And this is the world that we're moving towards. And my belief is that in 5 years, maybe I'd look completely crazy or I'd be right. And I bet I'd be right.
I'm sure you're going to be right. absolutely. I think when you have that belief and when you work towards it relentlessly, I think it does, in more often than not in my experience, it's turned out to be the way forward, right?
And only time will tell.
I think I've been on the B2C side mostly of while at Find, we also build B2B platforms, etc. But most of my references come from B2C to B2B, right? So from a B2C perspective, when I look at it, I think it's much easier to get it. It's the glamorous side of things.
Definitely.
The non-glamorous side is the hard work side is where B2B is, right?
Both are hard work, I think, but glamorous, definitely. B2C is glamorous.
It's glamorous, right? So I think there, you know, things like personalization, UI, UX, play a very big role in the B2C space. How do you see that evolving on the B2B side of things?
Yeah, I think the key thing over there is in the B2C space, you know, it's... glamorous is one word, but I would say it's also like super technical because you got volumes of data, right? So changing one button a different color can change your conversion rate. Positioning it in a different place will affect your funnel. In the B2B space, it's slightly different. What we see is that it's less of a sturdy pipe that you want to flow the traffic through. It's more of a fluid pipe that you have to make sure that suits every individual person in a way that doesn't compromise your code base, of course, because otherwise it would be a nightmare to scale. But what we see in B2B is because the volumes are in terms of number of people that you can get these insights from are not as high, qualitative interactions are so key. For us, bringing the B2C experience to the B2B world is something that like we pride a lot of, focus, effort, and effort on. Right. We want to make it as simple. Simplicity at scale is what we say. Right. Scale because you have so many different customers, each buying different products, each buying different price points. How do you structure it in a way that it makes it easier for them to do so? We see AI will do a great part over there. We're already seeing that in our current product. So in our new product, in a nutshell, really, you don't need any technical experience to know which markets you need to go through because the models that we've built will do that work for you. The right. entire product flow, the only input that we ask from the brands that we work with is, what's your website?
Right.
And then after that, everything is next, 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 until your emails are sent, your pipelines are built, your orders are collected, and so on. So really, UX, how do you simplify it? How do you anticipate what the customer needs? How do you anticipate how the customer wants to sell themselves based on everything that you know deeply right. about the industry?
Right.
And that's what's I'm very excited to launch.
Amazing, amazing. One of the other things about B2C is the way the business has evolved is there were the aggregators like Amazon,
mm-hmm.
and then there were the enablers like Shopify. They allowed brands to sell multi-channel, right?
Yeah.
In the B2B space, do you see an opportunity like that that exists for platforms to come up?
Yeah, for sure. So in the B2B space, what we see is that you really have two different spectrums. And it's like on the right-hand side, the technology players that have come out, you got like B2B marketplaces, right? You got Fair, you got Anchor Store, you got Creo8 in the UK, Inventa in Brazil, Piba in Hong Kong. Again, long for hours, right? And on the other side of this, you got people like NuORDER, Jour, Shopify, technology layers that predominantly focus on workflows, catalogs, products, simplifying a process. They generally don't take too much. They don't really focus on new customer origination, new order origination, like an Amazon would in the B2C space, or a Noon or a Namshir or any of these marketplaces. Over here, their main value prop to the customer is, hey, new orders. What we see is that essentially these two spectrums are, descending from. On this side of the fence, you have the ERPs, the Oracles, the SAPs, the Dynamics. They're the systems of record that were great at organizing your financial data, your inventory, et cetera. But now they're taking a step closer towards the people. Hey, not only are we gonna connect to your ERP, but we're gonna also help you manage your entire customer flow with your customer. They can log in and place orders directly with right. you. But they don't take a cut
right.
because it's my existing business. Why would I pay anyone a cut?
Right.
On that? I would absolutely not if I was a distributor. On this side, where are they descending from? The marketplaces. They're descending from the trade shows, the distributors, the agents, and who are all main value prop, new sales, new business, etc. And what we see is that they started actually coming closer towards the product side. They're like, hey, actually, you know what? I'm going to bring you new business, but I'm also going to organize your catalog. I'll also give you recommendations. I'll also tell you where to sell. And what we saw was that often, these two different players, nobody won the market. Why? It's because they serve the needs of two different segments of the entire market. If I'm a young, up-and-coming brand, if I'm a small distributor, SME distributor, who just signed its first 10 brands and is just going into the market and placing it in stores, and I want to, anyone that's distributing,
in my top of my head, yeah, I believe that having a platform is going to make my business better. I believe that this is something I need, but it's not mission critical to me.
Right.
Today, what's mission critical to me is sales, 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 sales. And that's the main driver of their business. That decides whether they live tomorrow to be able to go there.
Yeah.
And so that's over here. Right. Those players would be much suited for the B2B platforms. They would love those. And that's where they get a channel of acquisition.
Right.
You go to a slightly bigger company, a Shalhoub Group, an apparel, or even one of these big brands like Guess, Lacoste, etc. For them, they're like, hey, wait, I'm big. I worked a lot to get here. And for me, putting my brand in the wrong store might kill my business. I can't open it up like this, right? I cannot give you access. I need to control my distribution. Instead of selling wider, I want to sell deeper. Right. I want to have the same channels and perform better over there. I want to have sell-through over there. And so what we see is that, you know, who wins in the end? Are we going to live in a world where the buyers will have two platforms, one for small brands, one for big brands? Or do we really believe that they're... What happens to the brands that are growing?
Yeah.
And what we see is that in the world of AI, we're finally in a situation where workflow and software is commodity.
Yeah.
So whatever technology stack is there, you can get a couple of AI agents, spin them up, and you know, give it a couple of weeks. You have a great engineering team. You can rebuild any of these technology stacks and have them custom for you.
Yeah.
And today, we're in also in a world with the technologies that are available, the way that these LLMs have been trained, and the types of technologies that exist today, like Clay, Lucia, Apollo, etc. You're in a world where access is open better than ever before.
Yeah.
I know all the brands that are presenting at that trade show. I can click a button and I can know exactly who's the head of sales there. As a buyer, I don't even need to travel. So, you know, we're in this world where this change and this change are happening. And I believe we're at that forefront of that change to connect the people, the products, and of course the processes.
Right.
In a way that's never been done before, to actually give both sides the benefit, the best of both worlds. So you get the workflow, but you also get the customer acquisition. You get the selling deeper, but you also know who else is there, and you get the intelligence, like so, which was never possible without this time that we're living in. So it's like really a privilege to be building in this time.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think I always believe this is the best time to be alive.
100%.
I think the kind of leaps and bounds that we're growing by, and especially with AI, like you rightly said, with all the LLMs giving us, you know, enough time to do things that we should be doing more creatively. 100%. I think my last question on the B2C comparison is really the omni-channel piece, right? Where B2C has been thriving on omni-channel unified commerce space over the last 5 years or so.
100%.
Especially, how do you see the B2B space evolve in this?
Yeah, I see that, look, like the most important thing over here is, I mean, in B2B, really, you have three key models. You got this wholesale model. You got this consignment model, which some people say marketplace, but you're really giving them the stock. It's consignment. And then you got the third one, which is pure marketplace, meaning stocks with me, I'm listing with you, you pick up from my warehouse.
Right.
All these three really have the same thing. There's different people, products that are being sold, and the process is slightly different. Over here, you sell the goods. Over here, they may return it. And over here, it's just with you and it's just listed. They'll pick it up as and when it's sold.
Right.
What we see in the B2B space, like in B2C, it's slightly more straightforward. Consumer is there. He's buying. He bought it here. He bought it there. Your inventory is one. Done. Simple. And return comes in, goes out as well. B2B, the thing gets slightly more complicated because you're now, that whole concept of return, it's now, you know, transitioned into a new problem statement, which is sell-through.
Yes.
And sell-through is the holy grail of this industry. It's the crystal ball that we want to give our clients, which is we want to tell you what you should be buying.
Yeah.
That's going to save your cash flow. And for that, sell-through is a key variable in this mix. For the longest time, cracking sell-through has been a massive pain that's prevented really the ability for B2B to unlock this omni-channel type of concept. And we got amazing companies on that mission, right? You got Symbio, you got Miracle, you got Channel Engine and so on that are doing a phenomenal job on cracking a lot of them on a specific channel for sure. But what we see is that what happens to when your retailer base is not so sophisticated and they don't have an online system where they can send you an automated sales report? What if they're a small shop in the middle of Bahrain or Saudi Arabia that all they have is their POS? How do you connect to the POS? How are you going to go and sit and connect? But what we see is that those are also problems that are very vital for us to solve before we become, let's say, that crystal ball that people need. And that's what we're accelerating well towards, I would say. That's our focus.
Talking about the crystal ball, right? So if you were to gaze, and you did touch upon this, right? But how far away are we from a world where deals are closing autonomously, especially in the B2B?
I think you're going to get there for replenishments, meaning when the people have met, the trust has been already there. It's already happening in FMCG, that auto replenishment. But when we're talking like fashion, sports, other categories that are slightly more decision-based, someone needs to make a call. I think that in the next 3 to 5 years, we'll be at a point where a repeat purchase will be completely out of the hands of either sides of the equation, for sure. When we come to new business, I think we'll probably get there 3 to 5 years after that. And not because the technology is not there. I believe that the technology is only a year away. I think one thing that I've learned, which was a tough pill to swallow, is that, you know, people take time to change.
Right.
And so it takes time to get people comfortable, let them build trust with you, your business, your product, how things are being done. You want to always let them have the ability to say yes or no. Really? So we see that change before it's like widespread would probably take 6 to 10 years as a proper decade, depending on how fast people evolve. But it's the people, it's not the technology.
Right. No, I think that's been my experience too. I think it's mostly the people, and especially the people in the right chair, take the longest time to change, right? Yep. So yeah, absolutely. And I think from a longer term perspective again, right, maybe say in a 2035 scenario, a lot of this data is going to be as valuable as tax data to a government, right? And then therefore platform as a policy becomes like a way of life, right? Even from a governance standpoint.
100%.
And do you see yourself play a role there in that emerging economy?
I mean, it's very far off, but I do see that, because there's a massive benefit. When we do achieve our mission, I do see that there's a massive, massive, massive benefit for society as a whole. There's less wastage. There's more visibility. There's more tracking downstream for brands, but also for the government on what products are going where. Why are they going there? What came in? Is it the right... do we want the population that we've created to be exposed to certain products or not? In the US as well, I mean, as much as it's a free economy, there are restrictions. And getting visibility on those restrictions is very difficult, especially when you got gray channels, dark channels, and in entry into an exit is there. But when an ecosystem is like so, it's going to be much more transparent. I think overall it'll be for the betterment of mankind. I think it would free up a lot of wastage. It would make things a lot more efficient. It would free up people a lot more time. They'd be able to earn more, grow faster. Distribution would be much easier, scalable. Like ChatGPT went to 100 million in like 5 days. So yeah, it was because the distribution rails had already been created over the last 20 years. So we feel that the rails that we're creating today are the ones that are going to power the retail distribution in the future. And yes, I do feel that we'll probably get requested by a lot of governments to have access.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah, I think that's sure. A very positive note probably to come towards the end of the conversation. Sure. I think outside of the business side of things, right, going back to the person who Harsh is, right? Any one book that's changed your life or or a movie or what one of these, you know, between movies and books, I think most of our listeners could correlate to, right? So
I'll tell you one thing that changed my life recently. It was neither a movie nor a book, but it was this whole journey of signing up for the Ironman.
Oh, nice.
So I signed up for
Wow.
Yeah, okay. I signed up for the Ironman. You know, I got a coach, and one of the first things he said to me was like, "Hey, if you want me to coach you, like, you got to sign up to this race." And I remember I was 20 kilos heavier. You know, I had a lot of bad habits, not sleeping well, you know, late nights, early mornings. And I was just not in a good state, 15, 20 kilos heavier than now, not able to run 50 meters without stopping. And I just signed up for this stupid race. I say it's stupid race, but, you know, it that commitment to doing that race changed my life, changed every other day before that actual race day last year. So, you know, early wake ups, cutting out drinking, smoking, cutting out all of those things so that you can actually continue to run, continue to swim. Being scared of swimming in the ocean when you can't look down, you see like 50 jellyfish. Like that journey, being, you know, 50 kilometers in the middle of the desert and knowing that you only have 40 kilometers this way or 40 kilometers that way to get back home, and you're there alone, no one else around you, and the only thing that's on your mind is I better keep pedaling. And that changed my life drastically. And then I would say a book, if you want to take a book as well. I'd probably go with The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. I think, you know, when you go out and build a business, you know, you know it's tough, especially when I had done the first one, I knew it was tough.
Yeah.
But when you go out and you do it again with no safety net, knowing that there's no family business to fall back on, knowing that if you F this up, that's it, you're on the street.
Yeah.
That awakens a different kind of animal inside a man. And I just wish that same animal awakens on everyone else who wants it bad, just so that, because I went through it and I loved it. And I think that that book is one reference, but really the Ironman training also brought in a different lens on execution, on performance, on raising the bar for yourself. That changed my life radically, especially over the last year. And what's funny is I'm actually doing another one in 3 days.
Oh, really?
In Turkey.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow,
so
amazing.
After this podcast.
Heading straight on. Oh, my God. Okay. That's very inspiring. I think I've come across a lot of, you know, stories of people who've kind of used physical motivation to, you know, power their mind. But I think this is exceptional. This is, you know, going straight from 20 kgs higher to Ironman. I think that's a lot of commitment, right? So
yeah, once you commit, you can't back out.
Yeah,
no other choice.
Amazing.
That's
great.
It best type of choice to make.
Great. And I think we're just about out of time.
Perfect. Wow, time flew.
Yeah, time flew. I think this is a very deep conversation and very interesting. But for our listeners, where can they follow you and where can they follow Kingpin?
We're on LinkedIn. Yeah, find us there.
Amazing. And where can they follow you for Ironman?
I'm sure you can track my race. They will probably track it. They have these live trackers, but yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone should be following me. I'm going to be right at the back, catching up to everyone else.
As long as you're in the race, we're all there rooting for you.
Love it.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time, Harsh. It's been a pleasure.
Amazing.
Very, very inspiring to speak to you.
Likewise.
Until next time, follow us for more such stories on Retail Remix. You can find the Retail Remix page on LinkedIn. Also, for all your technology needs, whether B2B or B2C, follow us on www.find.com. That's FYND, find with a Y. And if you want to know why find is spelled with a Y, follow us, and I will ask you why not.